Good morning, Santa Fe, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the studios of KSFR and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen any time of day or night, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. We're talking today to Sam Hitt. He is the founder of Forest Guardians and also of Wild Watershed and onceaforest.org. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks, Mary Charlotte. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you here, too. The topic of our conversation today is forest policy in the Santa Fe area. There are all sorts of forest thinning projects going on here in this area. What is happening? Let's start with an overview of the projects we have and why they're happening.
Well, that's true. There are a lot of projects, and there's some that have already been resolved, and that is in the lower elevation pinyon and juniper woodlands in the Hyde Park area. That was on city open space in the Dale Ball Trail area. The city council voted basically not to do massive clearing on about 100 acres, but actually to fund homeowners to clear vegetation around their homes. Unfortunately, the fire department is not following through, you know, in the way they should, but it's not an immediate crisis like it was a few months ago. But now there's a whole other set of issues on the national forests, public lands in the higher elevations. The first project is called the Hyde Park Project, and there should be a decision any day now. That'll affect about 1,200 acres. It starts about at Nunn's Corner and goes up to the Black Canyon Campground. So as you're going uphill, it'd be on the right.
Hyde Park Road.
Yes, on the road up to the ski area. So this is, again, one of these massive Bush administration tree clearing projects or forest removal projects. I mean, they call it thinning, but this is not thinning like you would thin carrots in your garden. If somebody came and took 98 out of 100 carrots you had planted in your garden, you wouldn't call that thinning.
Well, you'd call it clear cutting.
You'd call it theft, I think, yeah.
Well, what's the purpose of it? What's the purported purpose and the real purpose if they're not the same?
Well, the purpose is, in the Forest Service mind, is to reduce fire risk. There's little justification for that. It actually may increase fire risk, at least in the short term, by creating a lot of flammable twigs and branches that'll be left on the forest floor, by opening the forest canopy to intense sunlight and drying winds. So instead of reducing fire danger or fire risk, it very well could increase the very thing that they're trying to control.
So why are they doing it? I mean, there's presumably forest ecologists and fire experts advising them.
Well, there's lots of money. This is where the game is. There's about $2 billion that Congress has appropriated as a part of the Bush administration's Healthy Forest Initiative and Healthy Forest Restoration Act. These are laws and regulations that have been in effect for about 4 years now, and basically that's all the Forest Service does now, or that's what mostly they do, is these fuels reduction projects, as they call them, designed to reduce fire risk.
But, the logs in our little Hyde Park Road area are not worth money. I mean, this is not a timber situation, is it?
Yeah, no, that's true. But it costs the taxpayers about $1,000 an acre to go in and clear these trees. So they will be masticated by a huge machine. They won't be hauled off to the sawmill. This is a machine that has this gigantic rotating head and will be lowered over the top of the tree and basically just pulverizes the tree. It sends these small bits of wood at huge velocities all over, and it's quite a process. I'm really concerned primarily about the impacts of soil. Anyone who has a concern about sustainability and the long-term productivity of our forests would be worried about soil compaction, loss of topsoil, soil erosion, degraded water quality downstream, loss of fish habitat, and especially on the ridgetops. And that's where they want to reduce number of trees to 98%. So from about 1,000 trees to an acre to about 40. There's very little topsoil on the ridgetops now, and when it's exposed to the wind and the rain, it's going to erode very rapidly, basically turning these ridgetops into barren islands. Right now,
what for?
Well, these would be fuel breaks, as the Forest Service calls them. So they would theoretically would be stopping fire from jumping from ridge to ridge. In the Santa Fe watershed, which is just to the north, about 7,000 acres have already been cleared, and there's about 50 miles of these ridgetop fuel breaks, and you can see them if you walk up Atalaya and walk over the backside toward Thompson Peak, and it's the impacts to soil and sustainability that I have a big concern with.
Let's backtrack for a moment and talk about the reality of fire. We, on this program, interviewed the author of a book called Wildfire, which really discussed in some detail a lot of the myths around forest fires. And one of them is that you can prevent forest fires by thinning forests. According to the scientist that I interviewed, fire is caused by drought and wind, not by there being trees in the forest. And while you can maybe reduce the intensity of a fire somewhat, you can't really prevent fires by thinning forests.
Well, yeah, let's just back up a little bit. These are fire-adapted forests in the Southwest. So, you know, fire has been part of the ecology. These forests are shaped and adapted to fire. Hot fires, cool fires, fires that go up in the crowns of the trees, fires that run along the ground. And the intensity of the fire and the size of the wildfires are based on climate. So during times of intense drought, the fires will be relatively hot and widespread. And there's some forest ecosystems that have long intervals between fires. But when fire comes, the fires are very hot and a lot of the trees are killed. For example, the high-elevation spruce fir forests. And we could see that in the Vivash fire in the year 2000. Almost every tree was killed on the south side of Elk Mountain. But there's been a huge regeneration of shrubs and trees and grasses. And it's an incredible wildlife habitat now.
Which is counterintuitive to the human mind that much destruction actually furthers the habitat and makes it better.
Yes, that's true. And we just have to think of fire kind of like rain is to the rainforest. Without fire, we don't have the type of forests that currently grow in the Southwest. So every forest ecosystem, from the pinon juniper to the ponderosa pine to the mixed conifer to the spruce fir, are all shaped by and adapted to fire. And you're right, the intensity of the fire, the scale of the fire is dependent on climate. Now, what the Forest Service is concerned about is that the forests are relatively dense, and therefore when fire comes through, they're relatively hot and widespread. And that is because the period from 1975 to 1995 were the wettest years in the Southwest in the past 1,000 years.
Amazing.
So, and this, of course, has been the time of tremendous growth in human population. So these fires that we can expect in the decades to come will be relatively hot and widespread. Now, but let's just take the Cerro Grande fire up in Los Alamos back in the year 2000. That was considered a huge disaster. Well, actually, only about a third of that fire was very hot, where every tree was killed. Now, a lot of those areas are right adjacent to Los Alamos in the Ponderosa Pine Forest, so, you know, it's pretty shocking to look at. But if you go over the ridge as it burned on toward Abiquiu, you can see the fire did a lot of benefits. It ran up in the crowns of the trees. It went along the ground. It created a lot of diversity. See, this is the problem with our forests today, not just around Santa Fe, but throughout the West, is there's a monoculture. There's even-aged trees, there's dense stands, and that's...
Because they've been planted, or...?
Well, it's a result of fire suppression, old-growth logging, livestock grazing, which disrupts the natural fire cycle by taking away the fine fuels. And partly the result of climate. So to try to parse out each one of those factors is is difficult, but it's fairly accurate to say that they all interact and have caused the conditions that we face today.
So in terms of realistically being able to prevent fires, is that a viable idea?
Well, the problem here, why do we want to prevent fires? I mean,
exactly.
There are a good argument to be made for people who live in the woods that you want to reduce their risk of fire. And that, fortunately, can be accomplished by doing very little fuels reduction right immediately adjacent to the structure. Like the first zone is within about 30 feet, and then the next zone is about 50 feet. So a total of about 130 feet around the structure, if you reduce it down to very little in that first 30 feet, then progressively less as you move out. Good research being done by the Forest Service researchers has shown that that structure will survive even the most intense hot crown fires that move through, like in Los Alamos. Now, a lot of homes burned in Los Alamos, over 400, and it cost the taxpayers hundreds of millions of dollars to replace those homes. And that's because the folks up there
– As opposed to the insurance companies?
That's a good question. The insurance company, so the people lost their homes. I mean, it's a big tragedy, and I'm not trying to make light of this, but they got in many cases insurance money and also compensation from the government. So, financially they're doing good. They lost their heirlooms and things like that, and that's not good. But if people do this fuels reduction immediately adjacent to their homes, they'll be able to reduce their fire danger and be able to live in the woods. But now in the Hyde Park area, we're allowing people to build, in many cases, very, very expensive subdivisions and homes in these fire-adapted landscapes, assuming that the public will come to the rescue if there's a fire, and without requiring them to do any fuels reduction around their home. That's not right. We should be controlling the type of development in these fire-adapted landscapes, and we should be requiring people to do this fuels reduction around their home so they won't be at risk and expect the public to rescue them at the last minute.
When we look at the forest policies that exist today, what you're talking about is a very large amount of money that's been allocated for this. Are people spending the money simply because it's there? I mean, that's what I'm wondering.
Yeah, of course. And it's just classic human behavior. You put out a pot of money and then people try to figure out ways to spend it. We have a crisis in our forests. We have too many roads. We have huge problems with water quality. 80% of the streams in New Mexico don't meet federal Clean Water Act standards. We have a huge problem with endangered species. So all those issues could be addressed, but no, we're not addressing those. We're addressing fire because there was a window of opportunity the Bush administration saw in the early in their first term that they jumped on. The Democrats and the major environmental groups in D.C. were like deer in the headlights. They were just frozen and they didn't act properly in the Bush administration pushed these crazy policies that based on fear of fire.
So fear is a theme in politics that we could talk about at length. But when we realistically talk about fire, I mean, there are real issues. There is a ski area. There are people living in the woods. What do you think is a rational fire policy?
Well, that's
clearing around their house. That's one thing.
Yeah. And that's clearly what has to be done, and it was clearly not done. If you look at the homes in the Hyde Park area, for example, 95% of the homes live in very, very hazardous conditions. They haven't taken those fuels reduction measures. And it's relatively expensive to do that. It's about $1,000 an acre, but there's federal funds available that'll pay 70 to 80%. So there's no reason that it shouldn't be done. So, but beyond that, in my opinion, we have to learn to live with fire. We are not going to control fire in the new climate that's coming down the pike.
New Mexico, because of climate change, even if we all stop driving cars today, climate change is happening.
Yeah.
So
it's front-loaded. With the carbon in the atmosphere. And outside of the Arctic, the American Southwest and northern Mexico is experiencing climate change more rapidly than any place in North America. So we are going to have hotter, drier conditions. We're going to have longer fire seasons. The fires are going to burn at a higher elevation, and there's going to be more of them. And we're going to have to learn to accept fire, to live with fire safely, but we're going to have to get over this fear of fire and not be railroaded by politicians that have hidden agendas.
We're talking to Sam Hitt, and the question of the forest in the Hyde Park area as it exists now, there has been some natural forest thinning that came about as the result of the bark beetles.
Well, that's true, and a lot of people think that the dead pinyons are a big fire hazard. In fact, they're not. There's been a lot of good research. So what we're concerned about in the pinyon-juniper woodlands is these fast-moving crown fires that just hop from the top of tree to top of tree. They burn so fast that they only burn the very fine fuels, twigs and needles at the top of the trees. But when a tree is defoliated by the bark beetle and the needles have fallen off as a result of the bark beetle, those fires don't have those fine fuels to carry them through. So actually, when a crown fire hits a patch of dead pinyons, it stops. So that's good. So the bark beetle has, in effect, created these fuel breaks in the forest, and the pinyon juniper woodlands are at relatively low risk of these dangerous, fast-moving crown fires.
That's another counterintuitive.
Yeah. Thing. Yeah, it is. But again, we have to learn the place where we live, and that's key to living in the Southwest.
So, what is the impact of cutting what they're calling fire breaks into forests? What is the impact on habitat? You've talked a little bit about the impact on soil, on watersheds, streams, rivers.
Well, one of the huge problems, to back up a little bit, we have a National Charter of Environmental Protection. It was a law. It's called the National Environmental Policy Act, signed into law in 1970 by the great environmentalist Richard Nixon. So we have rights to be informed participants in this decision making on national forests, our public lands. One of the key things the Forest Service is required to do is analyze and disclose the impacts of its actions. So they're not doing that properly, and the public is being denied a role in the decision making process. And in effect, we have a parent child relationship. The Forest Service is the parent, and the public is the child. That's not the way it's supposed to be. It's supposed to be an equal relationship where we are empowered as citizens to make our views known. So the bottom line here is the Forest Service is segmenting these analyses into various small projects, and that is avoiding the look at the cumulative impacts. So that's the impacts on soils, water quality, wildlife habitat, and fire danger over a large landscape scale.
So hang on. So what you're saying is that the Forest Service, instead of looking at the impact of the entire project, is dividing it up into lots of little projects that the public isn't really commenting on?
Yes. It's they'll deal with the direct effects on habitat for birds, for example. But if that project is spread over tens of thousands of acres, as they plan to do in this area, then we will avoid the larger impacts. But we really have to – let's just take for the impacts on nesting birds. It's really simple to avoid those impacts if we don't burn and cut trees during the nesting season, which is about from April to late August for most species. There are 23 species of birds that we have documented in the Hyde Park area. They range from Cooper's hawk to the swallows to the towhees. A lot of them are migratory songbirds that come up from South America and Central America, Mexico. Let's say there's a bunch of purple martins find a beautiful hollow snag on a ridgetop, and their colony nesters, so there'll be 20 or 30 in one of these snags, and the Forest Service comes up during the nesting season and masticates that tree. Well, there go all the birds. That's an impact that they should be documenting. They can do that by doing surveys for nesting birds. They don't do that. They could avoid the impacts by, as I say, not doing the activities during the nesting season. So basically, we're just on the bird angle. That's a violation of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. This is an older law from the early 1900s. We are asking for volunteers, experienced birders, to go out and document where these birds are nesting, so we can put those on a GPS, provide that information to the Forest Service, and avoid those sites and avoid a violation of the Migratory Bird Treaty Act. So,
but the Forest Service doesn't seem to be concerned with violation of U.S. law?
Not unless they're called on it. They've been violating the Migratory Bird Treaty Act for decades. There have been some cases where we have won, but they haven't been significant enough. Like, for example, with the spotted owl, that's caused a big change in policy. But these fuels reduction projects, as the Forest Service calls them, are a widespread national program that's going to affect over 7 million acres. That's already affecting 7 million acres every year in the West. Millions of birds are being masticated, burned, destroyed. Wildlife habitats being degraded, especially the loss of soils, as I said earlier. The impacts of the so-called thinning, or what I call tree removal or forest clearing, are as equal to commercial logging. And we all now recognize that those were devastating for our national forests. But because of fear of fire has sort of blinded everyone, we're not looking at the impacts. We have to look at the impacts in the context of our existing forest. We have a crisis of roads. Now, the Forest Service will say, and they're right partly, that, oh, we're not going to construct roads in this. But they're putting these large masticators in the forest that create trails. To service those masticators, they have these six-wheeled vehicles. They're kind of like big ATVs that go in. All throughout the watershed, and I've seen there are hundreds, dozens of miles of these roads, these trails or two tracks, straight up and down slopes. So what I'm concerned about as they clear these trees and as they create all these trails with all this heavy equipment, that's going to make, and it in the Hyde Park area being relatively close to town, is going to attract the ATV users or the off, the dirt bike people to come in and use these. And
so you're making virtual roads.
You're making virtual roads, but again, we have a crisis with these ATVs throughout the National Forest. I mean, even the Forest Service recognizes now we have a crisis. Their use has increased astronomically as the price has gone down. And it's often kids, and they often drive in a very reckless way, and they seek adventure, and they seek new areas to colonize. And this is right close to town. So, our dense forests, relatively dense forests, now prevent access to ATVs. But as they're cleared and as this heavy equipment makes these trails, I'm really concerned. In fact, it's already happening.
What is the impact of the ATVs?
Well, again, it's soil erosion. It's destruction of wildlife habitats. Just the noise just drives nesting birds off their nests, exposing eggs and fledglings to predators and cold. So there's a huge volume of scientific literature on the impacts of ATVs on watershed condition. In fact, again, when you're talking about fire danger, and you have all these ATVs deep in the woods, and I have seen them on top of Truchas Peaks. That's in the middle of the Pecos Wilderness, which is totally illegal, but they go up there anyways.
I've seen them in the dog park where they're illegal too.
I mean, there's a tremendous problem in La Cañada now with the residents out there trying to control the ATV use. But kids like to start fires or smoke cigarettes, and they're deep in the woods, so fire danger increases.
We're talking to Sam Hitt. When you talk about forest thinning, you talk about these big machines that chew up the trees and turn them into just little, essentially, big pieces of sawdust. What is that what they do to thin and clear forests in this area as opposed to controlled burns?
Well, because this is so close to town and so close to residential areas, I believe, although I haven't seen the final decision, but we've gotten word that they're going to not do a lot of burning. They're going to do a lot of mechanical treatments.
And so what happens to the material that is chewed up, the tree?
It just lies
material
on the ground. It just
and
lies
is that
on the
not
ground.
Fuel that could burn?
It's definitely a fire hazard, but what I'm more concerned about is that if the depth of it is too great, it prevents regeneration of grasses and shrubs and other plants. So, again, you don't have the forest recovery coming through. Now, there hasn't been a lot of research done on this, on this whole mastication process. It's just technology on the fly. And often when that happens, we see the impacts decades down the road. I'm concerned about the whole nutrient cycling process. See, as a tree grows in the forest, falls over, becomes a log, and then slowly degrades and turns into topsoil. That's a whole process that takes hundreds of years. And now we're truncating that project. And ironically, those small chips of wood don't degrade because they don't hold moisture. They dry out very quickly. And the degradation process is caused by fungus that in many cases needs moist conditions that you'd find in a downed log. So, there's all these food chains and wildlife impacts that could result by this new way of reducing wood fiber again, it's a gigantic experiment on a landscape scale without controls and without monitoring.
Are they chewing up both? They're chewing up both live and dead trees, not just dead trees. Is that correct?
Mostly live trees.
Mostly live trees.
On the ridgetops, they're going after snags or standing dead trees as well, because those are considered lightning hazards.
Well, there's a couple of things that come to mind, and one of them is trees are little machines for taking carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere.
Yep.
So you are essentially, aside from everything else, increasing global warming.
When we started this whole project, Sarah Williams raised this issue, and of course, as many people know, we lost Sarah to a drunk driver about a month ago. And she brought up this issue of global warming. I've been involved in forest conservation my entire life, but I wasn't up on the global warming impacts. Well, I am now, and it is an incredibly serious impact that's been totally ignored by the Forest Service in their required analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act. This is not just a problem here; it's a problem all over the Southwest and the West in general. How much carbon is being released in the atmosphere by masticating, probably 100,000 trees. And we're trying to plant trees in Santa Fe and a lot of the big cities. Well, as we masticate them up on the hillside,
you can't plant enough to make up for that.
Yeah, we're just shooting ourselves in the foot. Now, the Forest Service will make the argument that, of course, fires release a lot of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and they're trying to prevent fires. We're not going to prevent fires. Fires are going to come. We're going to have to, as I say, learn to live with and try to establish natural fire regimes as much as we can. In many cases, that'll be low-intensity, frequent fire, so there'll be a lot of smoke. But the impacts to global warming, really, we got to take a hard look at. And that's what the law requires, and the responsibility is with citizens and with the Forest Service in a collaborative way to deal with this issue and to deal with it honestly.
There's another issue in addition to that, and maybe it's not a big impact, but it seems to me when you have these trees I mean, when you have these trees that are being chewed up by machines, these machines also probably use up an awful lot of gasoline that is also contributing to global warming.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a huge problem. And even a bigger problem is when those machines leak oil or transmission fluid, and gasoline is required to be brought into these machines in the woods, deep in the woods, like in our watershed, and chainsaws, to lubricate the chain requires oil, and that's a quart of oil per hour, so. It's a huge impact on water quality and putting carbon in the atmosphere as well.
We're talking to Sam Hitt. Now, who is in charge? We're talking city, county, state, federal agencies all have to do with forest policy, fire policy, and so on. Who is in charge in the Santa Fe area and the Sangre de Cristo Mountains?
Well, that's a good question. Santa Fe National Forest, 1.5 million acres, has a forest supervisor, and then it's divided up into districts, of course. Where does the buck stop? It stops with the forest supervisor on the Santa Fe National Forest. But, of course, he takes his policy from Washington. That is a man named Mark Ray, who is a political appointee from the Bush administration, a former timber lobbyist that dictates policy and more importantly, establishes the budget priorities. They have a large staff devoted to fuels reduction and fire control. The Santa Fe National Forest has at least one helicopter, year-round just to deal with fire suppression.
What does the helicopter do?
It runs around and puts out fires as soon as they get started. Maybe there's more than one helicopter, but there's at least one out at the Santa Fe airport that I've seen. That's a huge expense, to do that. And it's widely acknowledged that fire suppression is not always the best policy. In some cases, it is when it's near homes. But if fires are burning in the wilderness or in the roadless areas, in many cases we should just manage them. We should let them burn. We're again going to have to get over our fear of fire and all these political manipulations that are around that.
Well, I guess the reason I ask about who is in charge in this area is it makes a big difference on what the public's input is and what the public's input can be.
Yeah, and that's a good point. We really need a basic redress of grievances here as far as the Forest Service decision making process. The public doesn't have a role. The only place where we can have any effect of all is we go to court and we have these issues aired in front of a federal judge. The decisions are often very narrow and legalistic, and it has the effect of stymieing action, but it doesn't have the effect of advancing policy. We should be talking to Tom Udall, our congressman. Tom is a great advocate of forests. He's very informed on the issue and is very concerned about what the Bush administration is doing in the forest. He's one of the leaders in the Congress in this regard. I would urge you to go to Tom's
website.
Website and his town hall meetings, and make these views known. If you have problems with ATVs, if you have problems with logging trucks, if you're a bird watcher and see habitat being destroyed, impacts to water quality is a huge one. We should all be bringing these issues in front of Tom because ultimately we need a legislative solution to this problem. We need to dethrone the Forest Service bureaucracy from their positions of power and make citizens equal participants in the decision-making process.
We're talking to Sam Hitt. There are some things that the public will have comments about if they have a problem with ATVs, let's say, or whatever, but things like water quality. We don't even know. I mean, this is another whole thing to talk about is the impact of forest policy on the water we drink, on the watersheds that we live in.
Exactly.
What is that impact?
It's primarily sedimentation. Sediment comes from roads primarily. you know, again, we have this crisis. The San Fernando National Forest has the highest road density of any national forest in the Southwest. That's both Arizona and New Mexico. That's a legacy of decades of commercial logging. We need to be closing these roads, not just closing them to vehicles, but reducing their ability to funnel sediment into streams. We have to disconnect the road network from the hydrological system. That's a complicated, labor-intensive, and expensive process. But, you know, these are the problems that are existing on national forests today. There's nothing more important than water. Back at the last days of the Clinton administration, the former chief of the Forest Service, Mike Dombeck, made an effort to make water the driving principle, preserving water quality, enhancing watershed condition. I'm not saying that all thinning or management of forests needs to stop tomorrow, but it needs to be done in the context of our current conditions. It needs to be done in a scientific way that takes a hard look at the impacts, and it needs to be done where it's monitored and we can learn from our mistakes instead of making new mistakes that don't have to be made.
It seems that one advantage that we have going on here is that the trees aren't valuable for logging. And so there's not a conflict of interest with people who want to turn them into timber to board feet.
Well, they're not suitable to logging because 95% of the large trees are gone. You know, take the ponderosa pine forest. You know, it's up to 98% of those large trees are gone. And still, in that last 2%, they're still logging up near Vallecitos, and we're in court trying to stop that. But you're right. These are not commercially valuable trees. That's because they've all been logged out. You know, now we're having to face the unintended consequences of commercial logging, this huge road network, this plethora of smaller trees, altered fire cycles. And let's not forget the impacts of livestock grazing. That's still an ongoing impact that as the cows eat the grasses, those grasses are not available to fuel the low-intensity frequent fires that used to shape, in particular, the ponderosa pine ecosystem of the Southwest.
The pinyon trees were decimated by the bark beetles, but they have a slow growth cycle, but their role is important. Talk about the important role of the pinyon trees in New Mexico and also nature's mechanism for reseeding those trees so that they come back in the coming decades.
Yeah, it's a really good question, Mary Charlotte. And right now, the pinyon and juniper woodlands have been ignored. They didn't have any commercial value. Pinyons and junipers were considered weeds. As lands are overgrazed, then the woody vegetation tends to come in, and that's happened over millions of acres of the West. So, when I first got started in the late 60s, we were chaining pinyon juniper woodlands. In fact, you can see huge areas up on Row Mesa that's just gigantic ship anchor chain will be dragged between two huge caterpillars and just everything destroyed.
And what was the reason for that?
That is to create more forage for livestock, you know, take away the woody materials and create more habitat for grass. We're not doing that anymore, but Pat Lyons of the State Land Office has this insane scheme to make electricity by burning pinyons and junipers on state land. So there's a 60,000-acre project out in the Estancia area that will get going. It's called a biomass project. So we're going to, cut down these trees, put them through a furnace, generate steam, and produce electricity. It's absolutely insane. These trees can take hundreds of years to grow. They're subject to fire and insects, of course. So it's not a constant source of fuel. But the demand for electricity is constant. So again, we're going to have another short-term, high-impact a crazy use. Now, I'm really concerned about one of our archetypal species here, and that's the pinyon jay. It's an amazing bird, squawking blue jay that comes to your bird feeder sometimes, has seen a catastrophic decline in population since its population was first monitored in 1966. So we have about, we know we've lost about two-thirds of the population. Now, the pinyon jay plants the seed, plants the pinyon seed. If a pinyon seed drops out of its cone on the ground, it will not germinate. It needs to be planted by the jay. The jay plants it root end down, 3 centimeters deep.
Why is it planted? It's part of its feeding cycle. Is it eating part of it or something?
It's storing the seed to dig up later in the winter. So it's a food source. So this is what jays do. Actually, all over the world, there's a similar situation in Siberia, but. You know, the jays are incredible. I mean, they will plant 20,000 seeds and remember where each one is to about 99.9%. But the ones that they miss are why we have a pinyon juniper woodland. So with this catastrophic loss of the jays, then with the bark beetle, which is really an impact of global warming. There's been excellent research done in Los Alamos. It's mentioned in all the international climate studies that this widespread die-off or die-back of the pinyon is the result of a longer growing season that has allowed the bark beetle to go from 2 or 3 generations a year to 5 or 6 generations.
And the increased vulnerability of the trees.
Exactly, because of drought stress. But, you know, like we had a big drought in Santa Fe during the 50s. It was actually drier then, and it was longer. But we had very few loss of pinyons then. That was because it was bark beetle didn't have so many generations. The winters were colder and were killing the larvae inside the trees. So, you know, it's definitely a sign of global warming. So declining jay populations because of development and conversion of pinyon woodlands to grasslands. And so we have a long-term problem. Then we have a new problem. And so how are these pinyons going to regenerate? You know, we're not going to go out there and plant all the seeds, I can tell you that. So now there's new demands with biomass projects like these short-sighted ones that the state land office is doing. So there's a huge actually state forestry is trying to promote regulations that would regulate activities in pinyon juniper woodlands. I'm not sure that's a good idea because I don't think they have the best intentions. But there needs to be some comprehensive look. I mean, in fact, we've encouraged the governor to form a task force to, as he's done with water, come up with policies that would help guide actions that would preserve, protect, restore the pinyon jay in the woodlands.
We're talking to Sam Hitt. We've got a few minutes left. In the current Bush administration environment where many of the appointees in the Forest Service are coming from that administration in the White House, what is the role of scientists in helping to make forest policy? Forest scientists, the people who best know the conditions of soil, habitat, and so on.
Well, that's a good question. Unfortunately, a lot of the best scientists have left. A lot of the best foresters have taken early retirement. So, you know, we have positions, people in positions of power that are not guided by scientific principles. It's kind of like faith-based forestry. And, you know, I'm starting to look beyond the Bush administration. You know, how can we bring back intelligent management that's where the public has a voice, where science guides the process, where we really are aiming toward restoration of natural cycles, where we're informing the public about the role of fire. All these things are possible. But right now, we're going to have to survive the last 18 months of this administration. And quite frankly, we're going to have to go to court to do it. We've had a number of great victories in court that have been, you know, we stopped the new planning rule that was going to basically exclude the public from all comment on the forest plans, this next round of forest plans, the overall planning document for each national forest. We got the roadless rule reinstated, Clinton's roadless rule. So those are kind of the big picture items. There's a lot of smaller court actions. We're in court up in Denver at the Tenth Circuit trying to stop an old growth sale up near Vallecitos. So I would encourage the listeners to really act from your heart to when you see problems in the national forest, to bring that to the attention of the politicians, you know, especially Tom Udall, who would love to hear your firsthand experience, and get out in the woods and enjoy them. I mean, you know, we with all the problems, there's still a tremendous refuge of solitude and peace.
What are the next actions that you are working on in terms of looking at the Hyde Park forest thinning situation, or forest clearing, I guess you should say?
Yeah. Well, the Forest Service is about ready to come out with a new document. We challenged about a year and a half ago. They did what they call a categorical exclusion, which was an improper document. That basically excludes the public. They don't have to do any analysis under the National Environmental Policy Act.
And so no environmental impact study.
Right, exactly. Now they've seen the error of their ways. They're doing an environmental assessment. This is a lesser document.
Than the impact study?
Than the environmental impact statement. What they need to do is a comprehensive, programmatic environmental impact statement for the entire 70,000 acre that goes from Hyde Park all the way to the ski area. And, you know, engage the public. We have proposed a citizen's alternative for this roadless area that would deal with the fire danger, that would identify areas where wildland fire use could occur safely, that is, let fires burn when they start without suppressing them immediately, and then also areas where fire should be suppressed. Basically, nature is a better manager than the Forest Service, and in many cases, we have to let nature take over the management.
And prevent what we can to any harm to life or human property.
Yes. And we have the tools, we have the knowledge to do that in many cases. So I would encourage everyone to go to our website, onceaforest.org, and there'll be an alert up there very soon to show what you can do to make your voice heard in this Hyde Park project. That will be there'll be a 30-day comment period. Then we'll have an opportunity to administratively appeal this, and we'd love to get people to join us on the appeal. Last time we had over 20 citizens joined us. It's a long ways from over, but you know, we need to galvanize the public to protect our backyard.
Sam Hitt, thank you so much for being with us here on the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Great. Thanks a lot.
People can go to onceaforest.org to check out this work. And is there, for non-computer users, any phone number that people can call?
Well, you can call mine. I'm in the phone book, Sam Hitt, H-I-T-T, and it's 438-1057.
Thank you so much. Sam Hitt is the founder of Forest Guardians and of Wild Watershed, and you can once again see onceaforest.org. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. And after that, jazz.